and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those who love you will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry. No more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you, get your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement and inspiring achievement. Yes, we'll all go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyds of London will be loaded when they go. Oh, we will all fry together when we fry. We'll be friends, fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our repository. Yes, we'll all fry together when we fry. Now by the old mail, there'll be a storm before the calm, and we will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake, with complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char. Let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a Te Deum when you see that our stadium and the party will become as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and waste your turn. When it's time for the fallout and thanks to your causes all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we'll all go together when we all go together. Yes, we'll all go together when we go. Tom Lehrer's song about nuclear war seemed especially appropriate in the wake of Netanyahu's speech to Congress. Perhaps wake was an unfortunate choice of words. Of course, as the lyric pointed out, there wouldn't be anybody left to hold one. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we stream live every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We're glad you joined us, and we hope you'll visit freedomslips.com to show your support for all the great shows that they provide on their network. And right now, I am proud to welcome my friend and co-host, Mike Palaszczuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome back special guests Ole Domegaard, Sherwood Ross, Mickey Z, and Phil Ferruccio. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Port Orange, Coral Gables, somewhere in Spain, Queens, Astoria, New York City, and wherever you are. Well, I watched the NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt last week only because I had to, complete with ominous music and drum beats. This is the NBC News with Lester Holt. Homeland Security funding in limbo. What led to Missouri killing spree? Putin critic gunned down in Moscow. How Jihadi John became the most wanted terrorist in the world. Lions, bears, tigers, oh my. Snow, ice leads to hundreds of accidents in Texas. All sponsored by Razor Wire Dental Floss. When your mouth is filled with blood, that's when you know you are really doing some good.
Yeah.
This is what a free press is. If Lester Holt were a CIA agent and the show was written by the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the Sales Department of General Electric, Goldman Sachs, and General Motors, how would the show be anything different? I just don't understand it. And there is a punchline here, but I'm not getting it. And now this word from National Public Radio. Soldiers are not heroes. We know that. They are killers, murderers. Killing is killing. Murder is murder. Even if you are wearing camo. They have been fooled into believing they are protecting us from terrorists. 9/11 was an inside job. It all goes back to that, day. All welcome home parades will now proceed directly to the county courthouse. This has been the National Public Radio PSA you have been waiting to hear for the past 12 years. And now it is again time for If I Were a Real Reporter by Brian Williams, NBC News. Hello, I am Brian Williams, a real reporter. This does all seem real to you, doesn't it? I've conducted an interview with Dr. Kevin Barrett, author and radio host from Madison, Wisconsin. Mr. Barrett, some have said that I'm not a real reporter, but a CIA agent posing as a reporter. What do you say to this now that you see me close up, in person, a real person right here, across the desk from you, talking to you, a real person right here next to you, and you see all around you the coffee, the snacks, all this stuff. So, Mr. Barrett, what do you think then? Huh?
In the golden age of Western theater, the century or so spanning the not quite overlapping lifetimes of Shakespeare and Molière, stagecraft was such a disreputable enterprise that actors were buried in unhallowed ground. In our age of celebrity idolatry, listening pod and deep. But back then, when Western civilization was still rising, something seemed even borderline demonic about people who spent their lives feigning, lying, faking it, pretending to be people they were not. Today, the distinctions between reality and illusion, news and entertainment, history and myth, has been annihilated. We're living in the society of the spectacle, so presciently predicted by anarchist philosopher Guy Debord. Today, anyone who learns about a riveting public spectacle through corporate mainstream news channels and believes the event actually happened as advertised is quite literally clinically insane. Such a person is like an audience member who climbs onto the stage to stop the murder of Julius Caesar, believing the assassination is actually happening before Stalin. Or like a person in the movie theater who claws through the screen in an attempt to enter Middle Earth or the Starship Enterprise or some other alternate reality I'd tell you about. The people staging false flag terror spectacles repeatedly get caught red-handed and even confess after the fact, but that doesn't stop them from fabricating more and more such events at an increasingly rapid pace. The show must go on.
Thank you, Dr. Baird. This has been If I Were a Real Reporter by Brian Williams, NBC Nightly News. This does all seem real to you, doesn't it? Huh?
We would like to introduce a new sponsor to the New American Dream Radio Show. Please join us in welcoming the United States Department of Homeland Security. We exist in order to protect the American way of life. The American way of life. Eating Doritos in the dark while watching television while clutching a cookie for it. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Remember the communist Tommy Pinko threat. Red. The domino theory. The Palmer raid. Anarchy. Chaos. Anarchy. The War of the Worlds threat. On radio live. It was almost real. Then came Dark Wars, the criminal threat, the war on drugs. Bill Prison, fast, put the flaxen and long hairs in jail, saved the country. That was close, wasn't it? Then the buzz was all about the big D threat from the South country. Then came dark innocent small towns and homes, the terrorist threat. Now sneaking into our computers and cell phones, the conspiracy theorist threat. Just one thing after another. What will it be next? We don't know, but when we decide, we'll let you know. The United States Department of Homeland Security. We exist in order to protect the American way of life. The American way of life, eating Doritos in the dark while watching television, while clutching the cookie pillow. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Our first guest of the night is Ole Domegaard. Ole Domegaard speaks to us each month from Spain. Here's a little short, here's an introduction written by Ole, or it comes from his website. And Chuck, if I go too long, just start this, bring up Ole and I'll stop. My name is Ole Domegaard. I'm a prize-winning author, investigator, former journalist. For more than 30 years, I've worked very hard on solving the mystery behind the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, something that has turned out to be a very dangerous task and has cost the lives of some dear friends. Not only do I humbly believe that I've now managed to solve one of the century's biggest murder mysteries, my extensive research has also revealed incredible links to other big political events like the killing of JFK, John Lennon, Robert Kennedy, Che Guevara, Salvador Allende, Pablo Neruda, and many others, as well as the cold-blooded sinking of the MS Estonia, taking almost 1,000 innocent lives. I've made hundreds of international radio interviews on stations like Red Eyes Creations, The People's Voice, Project Camelot, No Lies Radio, and The Real Deal, which has caused a tidal wave of international interest. I'm totally dedicated to revealing the New World Order's agenda, including false flag operations all over the world. It is important for me to point out that I'm not here to spread fear by exposing the truth in whatever form it takes. My goal is to prevent the so-called global elite from turning this beautiful world into a scary, controlled, and fearful place. We all deserve so much better. It's time to stop the madness. And now, yeah. Ole Domegaard.
Wait a second, I got the wrong one. Apologies for that.
Chuck, are we still trying to get Ole on? Well, it seems we're having trouble getting Ole's interview called up. He spoke to Chuck earlier in the day or earlier in the week. I'm not sure exactly, but Chuck is working hard to get the interview to play. I can't hear anything. I don't think it's just my phone. I really can't hear.
I'm gonna restart that. after changing something, and we'll see if it works better.
Okay. All right. Sounds good.
And once again, we have our columnist, Ole Domingar, joining us from somewhere in Spain. And he's just been on a trip to Scandinavia. He's going to tell us about it. Welcome to the show, Ole.
No, Chuck, I still can't hear it. I did hear you introduced, but when you went to Ole, I couldn't hear. And right now, I do hear some noises, but I can't make it out. I don't think it's just my phone. Is there something we can do to make it better? Chuck?
Yes, Mike, you were having trouble hearing that?
I can't hear it at all. Are you hearing it through your?
I think so.
Okay. Let's try this. Could you start it over again? And even though I can't hear it, I'll just be quiet, and maybe it's other people are hearing it. Maybe it's just my phone.
Okay, I will do that, and I'm going to go. I'll see if I can listen to it some other way and find out if it's coming out.
Okay, all right, sounds good.
So again, I won't be in front of the computer.
Dar joining us from somewhere in Spain, and he's just been on a trip to Scandinavia. He's going to tell us about it. Welcome to the show, Ole.
I'm going to try to prepare the technical
Well, that's very interesting, and I'm especially fascinated by your mentioning Lee Harvey Oswald's girlfriend. Do you know which vaccine that was? Was that the soft or the Sabin vaccine?
Thanks, Olay.
One life to live, that's all you got. And then, at that time, the time, what thoughts will pass through your brain if there is time? If we could talk to the dead, what would they tell us? Go faster? Slow down? Give up? Don't ever give up? It sure would be nice to know, wouldn't it? Well, we've got an app for that. Talk to the dead, get answers for your smartphone. At that time, the time. What thoughts will pass through your brain if there is time? If we could talk to the dead, what would they tell us? Go faster, slow down, give up? Don't ever give up. Sure would be nice to know, wouldn't it? We've got an app for that. Talk to the dead. Get answers for your smartphone. For $19.95 monthly sign-up fee required in some states. May cause liver damage. Stop using if you see bizarro Bugs Bunny and or dots or jiggly lines before your eyes. If you experience hypertosis, hoopatosis, halitosis, or chronic Bee Gees music ringing in your ears, consult your doctor. Not yet available in Iowa.
And now for another episode of On the Road Again. Luke. The trucker says goodbye to wife and family, headed from a town in Idaho to upstate New York. He's hauling Count Chocula, dark chocolate so dark it's almost maroon, wouldn't you say? How many cases, how many boxes, how many ounces per box? He knows more than others may know. Way more. It's his job. Listens to country music, talk radio, late night, all night talk radio, deep, deep in the night, the dark, so dark it's almost maroon. Boston, Wellstone, OKC, Sandy Hook, aliens, ghosts, 9/11, Bigfoot, it's all there on late night talk radio. Luke calls in, but then doesn't know what he should say, so he just hangs on. He wants to talk, but should he? He knows what others don't know. He knows more than others know. Why? How? Who is he? He's just a guy on the road in the middle of the night who knows.
And now for another episode of Just Living the Dream, episodes in the real life of real Americans. We see the Thomas family in the SUV. Mom is driving into the drive-thru and everyone else is watching individual TVs. Mom hollers back asking what everyone wants on their burgers. Nobody answers. Everyone keeps staring at their TVs. The drive-thru lane inches forward. Mom grows increasingly nervous. She hollers louder. The children turn up the volume on the TVs. Mom screams that they are getting dangerously close to the order box. We have to decide. We have to decide. Still no answer. Still no answer. Hello? Tune in next week for another episode of Just Living the Dream, episodes in the life of real Americans.
And now, sponsored by Powder Milk Piroshki, the view from my Piroshki cart. Grandma Kalashnikov writes on her website, her most recent column, Fight the Power or Get Used to Your Shackles. Secrecy is the enemy of the truth. The reason so-called conspiracy theories exist is simply due to government-imposed secrecy, forced by the military force and power of government on duped, unwitting citizens. End the secrecy and you will end most questions as long as government acts honestly and truthfully and scientifically and ethically. It is dishonesty and corruption and lying and cheating by government which leads citizens to use their constitutionally protected rights under the precious First Amendment to question such lying and cheating and evidently criminal acts by government officials paid by forced taxation of taxpayers. It is lying and cheating by government which fosters all this. If government behaved honestly and openly with a conscience, there would be no need to question them most of the time. Unfortunately, your government is a pathological liar and cheater and a criminal outlaw, which belongs in a jail cell or at the end of a firing squad. Franz Jagerstatter, the White Rose, Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, Paul Revere, Jim Fetzer, James Tracy, Kevin Barrett, Gordon Duff. There's a reason they exist, a reason for what they do. On Babushka Kalashnikov's Corner, sponsored by Powder Milk Paruski. Heavens, they're tasty and expeditious.
And now a word from the New American Dream Language Corner. We have developed language over many days to say what is on our mind. It is highly nuanced, all sorts of words, and we need all of them because human beings are complicated and can think and feel to a highly sophisticated degree. And so why? Why is every radio station from Bakersfield to Staten Island the same? And every newspaper from Vancouver Island to Fort Lauderdale the same, saying the same things? And why is every local television news show the same? All the same.
Americans don't make cars or steel anymore. We make PR. We deal in ideas and fantasy. It's the mother of all wars, and it's all in your head. The new Battle of the Argonne, Normandy, Midway, Guadalcanal, Bull Run, Verdun, Custer's Last Stand. Crisis, actors. Crisis, marketing. ISIS, iced tea. The ISIS mobile and designer Fred Flintstone. Back to the Future in the ISIS Al-Qaeda DeLorean. As the ISIS turns, guiding ISIS. Search for ISIS. One ISIS to live. All my ISIS. Americans don't make cars or steel anymore. We make PR. We deal in ideas and fantasy. It's the mother of all wars, and it's all in your head. The new Battle of the Argonne, Normandy, Midway, Guadalcanal, Bull Run, Verdun, Custer's Last Stand.
And now this public service announcement. Got your camo on? We in America are under fire. Wear your camo. Kitchen camo, lawn camo, office camo, gym camo, school camo, car camo, and bedtime camo. You can't expect anyone to feel sorry for you later if you're not wearing your camo.
And now for another episode of Nick Cheney, The Shadow. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Epping Shadow knows. Sponsored by Benjamin Moore High Gloss Latex Wall Paint. Where does your shadow go when the lights are off? It has to go somewhere, dude. Your shadow is a part of you. You two are virtually inseparable, have been for quite some time. Susan Woosin, Tom Wom, Amy Bamey, Carl Warrell, Justin Dustin, Nick sits in a Maryland coffee shop, Cafe Yago, talking to other shadows about how sometimes they follow and sometimes they lead. It's a good gig on the whole. Nick has been there, though, that's for sure. He's tired. He's old. He's almost to the end, but it's not up to him, is it? Or is it? Nick Cheney is a part of Dick Cheney. Seeing so, so much, way too much. After the shower, taking a dump, all that freaking denture cream, squiggly white mountains. The evil finger paintings in the mirror. The shadow of the man behind the 9/11 attacks. All those men tortured. The murder of Paul Wellstone. Nick tells a joke to the table of shadows around him and then disappears behind his own coffee cup, lost in his own thoughts. The horror. The horror. Tune in next week for another episode of Nick Cheney, The Shadow. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
And another word from the New American Dream Language Corner. I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. What if the children of Waco had not been burned alive? What if our law enforcement, Janet Reno, President William Jefferson, Clinton, and military were not ruthless killers, but compassionate, intelligent people? I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. What if the children of the Oklahoma City bombing were not dead, but living their lives, developing their genius and talents? What if our law enforcement, Janet Reno, President William Jefferson, Clinton, and military were not ruthless killers, but compassionate, intelligent people? I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. What if the true killers of John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were reported by the big newspapers, TV news, and radio? We would not be stupid, and we would be able to understand what the American military, Barack Obama, Bill and Hillary Clinton, and American rich corporations are doing to us this very day. And our children would have a better world, and our grandchildren. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Oh, yeah.
And now the lives of the cowboys. We find Duke and Bubba Carl sitting in the squad car in front of Quick Trip. And we can hear Bubba Carl shouting at Duke. You believe that? Said Bubba Carl. I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. A bit later in the day, we see Officer Bubba Carl back inside the convenience store getting more coffee and a large muffin. He hears someone talking in the line ahead of him. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, says Bubba Carl to the woman as she pays and walks out the door. After lunch, Bubba Carl sat in the dentist's office waiting for Duke to get some work done on his left upper bicuspid. Duke was knocked out, but Bubba Carl heard the dentist talking with his assistant while he drilled. You believe in that? Said Bubba Carl, putting down his Time magazine, marching back to confront Dr. Donald. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. Well then, it was almost the end of the day. Duke and Bubba Carl were sitting in the squad car on the curb in front of the convenience store. Duke's jaw was numb, but he said, yeah, he could go for a huge muffin. So Bubba Carl said he'd fly if Duke would buy, and he got out to go get in line. On the way, Bubba Carl was stopped by a homeless guy who asked him for a quarter. After a few minutes, Duke looked back to see what was up with the giant muffins and saw Bubba Carl still talking with the homeless guy, who was pointing and gesturing and mostly doing all the talking while Bubba Carl listened. Duke watched Bubba Carl get back into the squad car without any big muffins. Bubba Carl sat down, stared straight ahead, and looked like he had the stuffing knocked out of him. Wow, he said. I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. The Lives of the Cowboys, sponsored by Big Muffins and the Clear Plastic Pouch.
Our second guest of the evening is Sherwood Ross. Sherwood Ross is a veteran news reporter. And Chuck, I will just go ahead with this intro and you just call and I'll just stop when Sherwood gets on the phone. Chicago-born Sherwood Ross grew up in Miami, Florida. His father, an immigrant from Russia, was a wholesale liquor salesman and his mother taught elementary school. Ross attended the University of Miami on a varsity debate team scholarship, where he majored in race relations and during his senior year earned money writing the weekly Vagabond 15-minute poetry show every Friday night on WTVJ-TV. At the same time, he worked as a reporter for the Miami Herald and wrote humor for its Fun in Florida magazine. His comedy, The Peacemonger, was produced in the University of Miami Student Box Theater in 1952. After graduation in 1955, Ross worked as a reporter for the City News Bureau of Chicago and then the Chicago Daily News.
Hello, Sherwood. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Hi, Chuck and Mike. And I was thinking, we're the first generation of human beings whose lives are being held hostage to the nuclear weapon. We can all be destroyed, every one of us on this planet. And it's the first time anything like that has ever existed. The facts are so terrible. If the American people knew them, knew how much more powerful today's atom bombs are, there would be demonstrations in the street against the three nuclear labs that designed them and the builders of these horrible weapons. There was talk last weekend to a New York City symposium by the Helen Caldicott Foundation. Philosopher Noam Chomsky of MIT said, so far, we've survived nuclear annihilation by pure luck. Chomsky quotes the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which warns, nuclear war is the black swan we can never see, except in that brief moment when it is killing us. So I'd like to read an article from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, written by three eminent scientists, Stephen Starr, Lynn Eden, and Theodore Postol. And just to give you a little idea, Postol is a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at MIT. Not at some unknown college. And his expertise is in ballistics. Stephen Starr is the director of the University of Missouri's Clinical Lab Science Program, and so on and so forth. Well, you know, a Russian intercontinental ballistic missile dropped in Times Square, fired into the United States that would land in Times Square would wreak incalculable devastation. Why the nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were toys compared to what the Americans and the Russians have today. Russia's believed to have 1,000 strategic nuclear warheads fired from Russia that can hit the U.S. in less than 30 minutes after being launched. And of this total, about 700 warheads are rated at 800 kilotons. In case you don't know what a kiloton is, and I didn't know, it has the explosive power of 800,000 tons of TNT. And well, would just one of those warheads hitting Midtown Manhattan do? Well, according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, within a few tenths of a millionth of a second, I mean a split second, the center of the warhead would reach a temperature of 200 million degrees Fahrenheit, or five times the temperature at the center of the sun. The enormous heat and light of the fireball would instantly ignite fires over a total area of 100 square miles. I mean, you can kiss Manhattan goodbye, and also parts of Jersey and Queens and maybe even Connecticut. Anyway, within 10 minutes of the detonation, fires from near and far would have formed a huge firestorm. At the Empire State Building, Grand Central Station, and the Chrysler Building in St. Pat's Cathedral, these are about a half a mile to three quarters of a mile from ground zero from Times Square. white from the fireball and melt the asphalt in the street, burn the paint off the walls, melt metal surfaces within a half second. Roughly 1 second later, the blast wave and winds of 750 miles an hour would arrive, flattening building and turning and tossing burning cars into the air like breeze in a windstorm. Slightly more than a mile from ground zero are the neighborhoods of Chelsea and Midtown East, Lenox Hill, and the United Nations. And for a split second, the fireball would shine 10,000 times brighter than a desert sun at noon over these neighborhoods. Like 10,000 desert suns, that's the heat they would be getting. 2 miles from ground zero, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, with all its magnificent historical treasures, would be obliterated, the scientists say. 2.5 miles from ground zero, lower Manhattan, East Village, Stuyvesant Town, the fireball would appear 2,700 times brighter than the desert sun at noon. Here, Midtown is bordered by the Hudson and East Rivers, and fires would start on both sides of these waterways, that is, in Queens and Brooklyn, as well as Jersey City and West New York. 3 miles from ground zero in Union City, New Jersey, Astoria, Queens, the fireball would be as bright as 1,900 suns and deliver more than 5 times the thermal energy deposited at the perimeter of the mass fire at Hiroshima. In Greenpoint, Brooklyn, the civic center of Lower Manhattan, clothes worn by people, would burst in the flame and melt, and uncovered skin would be charred. Fires would rage everywhere within 5 miles of ground zero. 5 miles away from the center, the white flash from the fighter ball would deliver twice the thermal energy seen at Hiroshima. In Jersey City, Cliffside Park, and Woodside, on Governor's Island, and in Harlem, the light and heat would be brighter, more terrible than 600 desert suns put together. Well, you can see that these are advanced weapons, and President Obama wants to spend another $1 trillion to perfect them. My God. 6 to 7 miles from ground zero, from Moonapie, New Jersey, to Crown Heights, Brooklyn, from Yankee Stadium to Corona, Queens, and Crown Heights, Brooklyn, the fireball would appear 300 times brighter than the sun at noon. The firestorm could engulf neighborhoods 6 and 7 miles away. 9 miles from ground zero in Hackensack, Bayonne, and Englewood, New Jersey, as well as Richmond Hills, Queens, the fireball would be about 100 times brighter than the sun. Within 10 minutes, everything within approximately 5 to 7 miles of Midtown Manhattan would be engulfed in a gigantic firestorm. A zone that would cover 90 to 152 square miles. Well, you get the picture. How long are we going to tolerate this terror?
I'm sorry we ran out of time, Sherwood. But,
I know it.
Thank you so much for being with us, and that was a powerful picture of what would happen.
Thank
Good night.
You.
We seem to have some technical difficulties. Chuck is trying to get Phil Ferruccio's piece up. Chuck, how are we doing with that? No, I'm not hearing anything, Chuck. Not hearing anything at all. We're trying to get Phil Ferruccio's piece It's the Empire Stupid. And we have a recording of that that's just not working right now. Chuck is working on it as we speak. Bill Ferruccio comes to us each week. At the top of the second hour, he comes to us from Port Orange, Florida. And Chuck seems to be having a little bit of trouble with that. Phil Ferruccio is originally from Brooklyn, and he's with a group that is trying to cut military spending and spend it on human needs. We don't seem to be getting that, Chuck. Chuck, any word at all about that? Chuck, I'm going to go to the next piece, if that's okay with you. Chuck, we're going to go to the next one. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. The Chicago Police Department operates an off-the-books interrogation compound, rendering Americans unable to be found by family or attorneys while locked inside what lawyers say is the domestic equivalent of a CIA black site, the facility, a nondescript warehouse on Chicago's west side, known as Holman Square, has long been the scene of secretive work by special police units. Interviews with local attorneys and one protester who spent the better part of a day shackled in Holman Square describe operations that deny access to basic constitutional rights. Alleged police practices in Holman Square, according to those familiar with the facility who spoke out to The Guardian after its investigation into Chicago police abuse, include keeping arrestees out of official booking databases, beating by police resulting in head wounds, shackling for prolonged periods, denying attorneys access to the secure facility, holding people without legal counsel for between 12 and 24 hours, including people as young as 15. At least one man was found unresponsive in a Holman Square interview room and later pronounced dead. Brian Jacob Church, a protester known as one of the NATO Three, was hailed and questioned at Holman Square in 2012 following a police raid. Officers restrained Church for the better part of a day, denying him access to an attorney before sending him to a nearby police station to be booked and charged. Holman Square is definitely an unusual place, Church told The Guardian. It brings to mind the interrogation facilities they use in the Middle East. The CIA calls them black sites. It's a domestic black site. When you go in, no one knows what's happened to you. The secretive warehouse is the latest example of Chicago police practices that echo the much-criticized detention abuses of the U.S. War on Terrorism. While those abuses impacted people overseas, Holman Square is said to house military-style vehicles, interrogation cells, and even a cage, trains its focus on Americans, most often poor, black, and brown. Unlike a precinct, no one taken to Holman Square is said to be booked. Lawyers and relatives insist there is no way of finding their whereabouts. Jacob Church learned about Holman Square the hard way on May 16, 2012. He and 11 others were taken there after police infiltrated their protests against the NATO summit. Church's left wrist was cuffed to a bar behind a bench in a windowless cinder block cell with his ankles cuffed together. He remained in those restraints for about 17 hours. I had essentially figured, all right, well, they disappeared us, and so we're probably never going to see the light of day again, Church said. On February 2nd, 2013, John Hubbard was taken to Holman Square. Hubbard never walked out. The Chicago Tribune reported that the 44-year-old was found unresponsive inside an interview room and pronounced dead. The Cook County Medical Examiner's Office could not locate any record for The Guardian indicating a cause of Hubbard's death. It remains unclear why Hubbard was ever in police custody. The combination of holding clients for long periods while concealing their whereabouts and denying access to a lawyer struck legal experts as a throwback to the worst excesses of Chicago police abuse with a post-9/11 feel to it. On a smaller scale, Holman Square is analogous to the CIA's black site, said Andrea Lyon, a former Chicago police public defender and current dean of Valparaiso University Law School. When she practiced law in Chicago in the 1980s and 1990s, she said, police used the term shadow site to refer to the quasi-disappearances now in place at Holman Square. Tracy Siska, a criminologist and civil rights activist with the Chicago Justice Project, said that Holman Square, as well as the unrelated case of ex-Guantanamo interrogator and retired Chicago detective Richard Zulli, showed the lines blurring between domestic law enforcement and overseas military operations. The real danger in allowing practices like Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib is the fact that they always creep into other aspects, Siska said. They creep into domestic law enforcement, either with weaponry like with the militarization of police or interrogation practices. That's how we ended up with a black site in Chicago. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck. And so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. Bring something to the table and never make direct eye contact with the policeman. Our next guest of the night is Mickey Z. Mickey Zezima was born and raised in Astoria, Queens, has appeared in a book with Noam Chomsky and in a martial arts film with Billy Blanks. With only a high school diploma, he has authored 12 books and has spoken and lectured in venues ranging from MIT to ABC No Real, from Yale University to Occupy Free University. Howard Zinn called him provocative and bold. And Mickey was recently featured in an article on the Huffington Post. Chuck talked to Mickey earlier in the week, perhaps. I'm not sure exactly what they did talk, but here it goes.
What's happening in New York City? Activism, and Mickey, welcome to the show. Oh, pleasure as always, Chuck. Happy to be here. So what's the latest up there? It's snowing as I'm speaking to you right now, once again. It's been a strange winter in that traditionally, which is a word I guess is irrelevant in the age of climate change, but January is a very harsh month in New York, and then February is also harsh but starts to taper off. But this year, February felt like January. Here we are in March, already like in the second or third snowstorm of March, and as I'm speaking to you now, the snow is falling, so the patterns are certainly shifting.
That's pretty crazy. Well, I know you're stuck inside a lot, but I'm sure you're still fairly active.
Yeah, there's definitely been less street activism, as you might imagine, because I think it's a smart move. The issues, of course, don't go away, but if you're out there on the street in weather like this, there's not much outreach to be done. If anything, it kind of fulfills the mainstream person's image of an activist as a fanatic. You know, these people are out here in the snow, and in some degree, it loses credibility as activists. So I have my fingers crossed, and actually I feel pretty confident that in the next couple of weeks, as the weather begins to improve, that things are going to pick up in New York, in particular connected to Black Lives Matter and so on. I think there's going to be a very, very active spring up here.
Well, that's good, yeah. I may actually be up in the Northeast, but probably only as far as Philadelphia, but it'll be an early thing.
Okay. Well, hopefully it'll be nice and comfortable by then, but this
is
not the time to do it.
So, there was an interesting piece about you on Huffington Post recently.
Yeah, it was a real kick. There's a woman named Nancy Wuling who covers for the Huffington Post my particular area of New York City, which is called Astoria, in the borough of Queens. And she did an interview with me pertaining to my background as a lifetime resident of this area, and called it the all-around activist. And it was definitely a kick to be on such a large website, and I've gotten some pretty positive feedback for it. So anything that, you know, it, and anything that helps get people aware of what can be done and recognize that right in their neighborhood, someone that's out there doing the activism, I think it's a positive thing. And on a personal level, she mentions my most recent book, Occupy This Book, and hints at my next book, which is Occupy These Photos. So, I mean, that's why we write and do this stuff, because we want people to hear us and provoke some thought. So I'm very grateful to be on such a popular website.
Well, I think it's great. And you have gotten some feedback from
her? Yeah, it's been, she herself, the woman who interviewed me, said that she noticed how widely it was being shared and so on. So I took that to say that the other pieces that she's done perhaps haven't even gone as much attention. So I take that as a pretty positive sign. And yeah, it's a way of reaching a new audience, which is always a big goal of mine. And I'm a big believer in the motivating power of example, where if someone reads about me, who, you know, looks just like anyone else in their neighborhood and sees the choices that I've made, maybe they're like, yeah, I should be doing some more too. And I'm pissed off about this and I should get involved. And so I hope that it has that power, where it gets people thinking a little bit more about how they can step up and, you know, join this struggle for collective liberation.
Well, if it does that, then that will have been a very good thing.
Yes.
What do you think of this recent thing with Boehner getting Yahoo to talk to Congress and all that?
I mean, on the surface, it's just the classic illusion of the two-party system. You know, it's just this one-upsmanship coming up next year being a presidential election year. It's hard to take any of that too seriously, because their entire careers are invested in maintaining the facade that they're these two discrete parties that represent these drastically different ideologies, when, as anyone who's paying close attention recognizes, that regardless of who gets elected, the same policies appear to be furthered. What I do find interesting is like the what's omitted in these conversations about Iran and nuclear weapons and so on, that, you know, Netanyahu, who is the leader of a country that has a large cache of nuclear weapons and is off the table in terms of discussion, the most aggressive nation in that area, he's speaking in the U.S., the only country that consciously used nuclear weapons on civilians. So it's like this discussion isn't happening. Like, all of a sudden we're talking about rogue states and the chance of some nation getting nuclear weapons and possibly using them, and the conversation's taking place in a rogue state that used and continues to use nuclear weapons on civilians. So there's like this Alice in Wonderland type of vibe to this that maintains, again, this huge facade that the United States represents democracy and freedom and has this, you know, very, very dynamic two-party system, when in reality, this is an ideal example of exposing what a fraud it all is.
It's funny, I haven't really even been thinking of it as anything to do with one party or the other, but as warmongers versus everybody else, and of course, most of the people in Congress would be on the warmongering side.
When you consider that over 50% of federal tax dollars go to the so-called Department of Defense, it's some version of the military, you realize that the people in power, Congress and so on, have a very vested interest in propping up that industry. That's what keeps the money flowing into them. That's what keeps them in office, gives them power, gives them access to more people with power. When they're out of power, they move to the corporate sector and get jobs on defense contractors' boards and so on. So it's this vast system that they have, this tiny 1% of people have a vested interest in propping it up and convincing us that there's this evil in the world, and that we must be willing to make all these sacrifices, financial and freedom-wise, to take on this evil, when we're sitting in the country that is funding all of this, and the only country on the planet that willingly, knowingly, openly use nuclear weapons on civilians, and continues to do so with the use of depleted uranium all across South Asia and the Middle East. So what this conversation to me is interesting for what's not being said. The rest of it just falls into the theater of the absurd that is geopolitics. But I think that the real lessons are to be learned in listening carefully to the silence, because there's so much that's not being said.
Well, I think that's almost always true with anything the government does. And what's not being said is more telling than what is actually said.
I concur, absolutely.
As often as not, that's because what is being said is out there to distract you from what's not being said.
Yeah, I mean, there is no benefit to those in power for the general public to be aware, to be sitting around contemplating, seriously contemplating why these situations just keep coming up, why there's so much conflict, why there's so much inequality, why there's so much repression. So this system of corporate propaganda, and which it just continues to advance because the methods of relaying it get more and more sophisticated, you know, from radio to TV, and now, of course, this instant gratification through the internet, this system is set up to distract us, as you said, to keep us focused on issues that won't do anything to stop the carnage, basically. And as we sit here, like, with the economy in ruins, with the ecosystem, you know, on the brink, and with social breakdown everywhere, it's getting harder and harder, I think, on some level, to distract us. So it has to become almost more cartoon-like, and bringing over Netanyahu and putting on this whole dog and pony show is an example of that, I believe.
Well, I think you're right. I certainly hope that it doesn't work, but not all that often.
Yeah. It's challenging when I have conversations with my friends and interact with people who aren't activists, who have very limited, it seems, very limited interest in following current events beyond headlines, it can be very disheartening, because they pretty much take a lot of this at face value, and that's the result of many, many, many decades of conditioning. It's not an accident. This is all very well coordinated and planned.
Who I think of as being open-minded extremely focused or even obsessed with ISIS and beheading and how horrible these people are, and we have to do something about it.
Again, what's not being said is fascinating here, because it's no surprise. It's one of the oldest ploys of people in power. I mean, when you think back to what parents say to children at very young age, you know, when children are acting up, like, no, don't go out there, there's a monster out there. Or, like, you create these false dichotomies in order to maintain some control. So people do that later on in life, where it's like, if you start to notice that because of the internet, people have a broader scope of knowledge, so then you have to create more and more evil enemies to scare them. So ISIS, and in no way, of course, am I defending ISIS. ISIS, it couldn't be more perfect. And of course, they didn't happen in a vacuum. You know, the United States has been very active in that region, creating power vacuums, funding certain groups, not worrying about where that money and weaponry is going to go. And it's been like that for many, many decades. So it's not shocking that these groups pop up. And when they do pop up, as far as the power elites in the U.S. are concerned. They're not at all upset. This is perfect. This is to show the world why we have such a large military budget, why there is this perpetual bombing, and why we have to tolerate when drones blow up a wedding party, because that's just collateral damage and it comes with the territory. It's regrettable, but we need to be out there fighting these demons. When anyone that reads a reasonable history of the United States, whether it's something like Howard Zinn's book or William Bloom's Woke State or Killing Hope, where you look at the foreign policy of the United States, you realize that the horrors that this country is responsible for are worse. And so, but so that's where the distractions come back in. All right, well, how can we keep people from reading that stuff? So we demonize those authors, we marginalize them, and then we put on these spectacles, Academy Awards, Super Bowls, and so on, to keep people focused on that stuff instead.
Oh, well, it's going to be some more interesting times, I think.
Definitely, definitely.
Well,
but it's a pleasure, as always, to be on your show and get a chance to talk about stuff that you know, that really needs to be talked about.
Well, you know, I really appreciate your coming on the show, and we've actually gone probably a little over time here, but it's been fun, and I hope we'll be able to get the whole thing in on the show. Thank you.
Me too.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Lorraine saying hi. Bye-bye. Well, folks, it's time once again to welcome
now, another episode of The View from the Grassy Knoll, sponsored tonight by Home Depot Riding Lawnmowers, Scott's Lawn Seed, and Wisconsin Foo Foo Mulch. His name is Jesse Washington. He's nobody. He's standing atop the concrete block by the pergola where Abraham Zapruder stood. He sees all the evidence, all the angles, all around him. He is nobody, and he is hungry. He stood there, over there, on the curb as a young boy watching the parade, the motorcade. He needs a place to stay for the night. His family is angry. He's an embarrassment. A grown man still watching the parade after all these years. There's nobody there. What are you looking at? He gets chased away, comes right back, stands here, there. You can see the whole world from atop that 4-foot concrete block. Jesse can see time, all time. He can hear everything, feel everything, everybody. It's too much. But he stands there anyway, seeing, hearing, feeling. He just feels. He owes it to someone. And now a message in a Boone's Farm bottle, some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. From Paul Craig Roberts in Washington, D.C., we get this.
The neoconservative threat to international relations. This past week, I was invited to address an important conference of the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow. Scholars from Russia and from around the world, Russian government officials, and the Russian people seek an answer as to why Washington destroyed during the past year the friendly relations between America and Russia that President Reagan and President Gorbachev succeeded in establishing. All of Russia is distressed that Washington alone has destroyed the trust between the two major nuclear powers that have been created during the Reagan-Gorbachev era. Trust that had removed the threat of nuclear Armageddon. Russians at every level are astonished at the virulent propaganda and lies constantly issuing from Washington and the Western media. Washington's gratuitous demonization of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has rallied the Russian people behind him. Putin has the highest approval rating ever achieved by any leader in my lifetime. Washington's reckless and irresponsible destruction of the trust achieved by Reagan and Gorbachev has resurrected the possibility of nuclear war from the grave in which Reagan and Gorbachev buried it. Again, as during the Cold War, the specter of nuclear Armageddon stalks the earth. Why did Washington revive the threat of world annihilation? Why is this threat to all of humanity supported by the majority of the U.S. Congress, by the entirety of the prostitute media, and by academics and think tank inhabitants in the U.S., such as Model and Weiss, about whom I wrote recently? It was my task to answer this question for the conference. You can read my February 25 and February 26 addresses, but first, you should understand what nuclear war means. You can gain that understanding at thebulletin.org. What would happen if 800 kiloton nuclear warhead detonated above Midtown Manhattan, 8023? If Russia, China, and the BRICS Bank were willing to finance Greece, Italy, and Spain, perhaps those countries could be separated from the EU and NATO. The unraveling of Washington's empire would begin.
You can read the rest of Paul Craig Roberts' address at the Information Clearinghouse. Look for Paul Craig Roberts. A message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes I've been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth has baked burritos, an apricot wheat beer, and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story. We now meet Carol Kopecky selling his wares on the lakefront.
Carol Kopecky stood at his stand down by the water, right under the statue of Piker McNugget the First. Carol's curios, like a portable cart in Times Square, had pedals and an umbrella and a display case for Carol's papers and trinkets and t-shirts and wild rice for sale in 5-pound bags. Carol stood by the stand in his yellow raincoat and rain hat and his white t-shirt that said, "I Heart Duluth." The blood-red covers of his copies of the news screamed, "Why did Robert Lund kill Mary Pine?" The wave slammed against the concrete bulkhead. He watched the big red ship, the SS William A. Irving, rise and fall. Boom, boom, up and down, riding the roller coaster. Carol Kopecky turned away from the water to watch back into the restaurant parking lot where the crowd gathered around the big cannons to mark the beginning of Haiva Talabi Week. The cannons shot out bags of toys and fake snow and ground taconite. It was a new, relatively new idea of the city chamber to promote the winter shopping season. Every year for the past, 10 years maybe, on the day the Edmund Fitzgerald went down, they arranged for the Irvin to be out on the water close by. Actually, it's towed out there a day or two ahead of time by the Coast Guard, and they get all the kids from West Duluth and the Shoulders and wherever else they might not get so many toys to stand around and wait for the cannons to go off and try to catch them. And everyone hears the cannons and they're supposed to think, oh yeah, I better get on my Christmas shopping. And then the mall and the downtown get flooded with all these people buying stuff. Somebody said once they could hear the damn cannons in Two Harbors and Virginia and Cloquet. Could be. They shoot up some taconite to celebrate the Iron Range and bring in those shoppers, and that might help some, and hope nobody gets hurt, but they're poor kids and parents, and well, they won't complain. And then they have Veterans Day tomorrow and a big parade, and then next week, Whoville opens up just down the water from here with 3 million lights and water, marshmallows, and we need them 12 Santas in a row and real reindeer from the zoo. And then with all that, maybe some of the stores get enough business to survive and be here next year and maybe try it again, huh? And then they give the kids a ride out to the boat with the Coast Guard, and they get to see Santa and eat supper with the crew, mostly retired sailors and realistic blue peacoats. And hear stories about sailing and taconite and probably stuff like that. Carol had never actually gone along. You have to be a kid or a parent. He was from the Iron Range, though, hard wood. And he knew something about taconite. He looked back at the screaming of the children, the wild, ridiculous laughter. They really are poor, he thought. Probably more poor than we were. He knew nothing about gold, at least not like this. It was falling down around here, a sort of fine gold mist. They thought about calling it Winter Festival, and the 100 other towns already had that. Then it was Dead Sailor's Day, and that didn't make you want to buy Monopoly boards and Elmo dolls, so then it became Good Winter in Finnish. And you can fit an awful lot of games and dolls under that umbrella. The half dozen little portable cannons roared. A boom, boom, boom. There, there, there's more. Get it, get it. He twisted to see mothers and children hunched over, chasing something along the pavement and reaching way up with their hands to make the whatever stuff come down faster and right to them. Carol turned again toward Lake Superior. He reached back for the statue and sat on the base, covering the water is for washing and beer is food gold plate inscriptions. McNugget the First had served many terms as mayor of Duluth, followed by the second, the third, and most recently, the town had again chosen a fighting McNugget. Well, before Mary Pine decked him. Piker McNugget the Fourth lay in his bed on the third floor of his London Avenue mansion to where he'd retired following the election. A one-term, one-nut McNugget, they were calling him, likely even in his own home. The race against Mary Pine had featured Pine's Edelweiss flowers showing up everywhere against McNugget's familiar beer testimonies and the edict going back quite a ways that Duluth brewed beer could have only the four ingredients: water, malt, hops, yeast. Nothing of the delicate microbrews like apricot or orange or vanilla beans. Pine had vowed to change all that. Carroll crossed his ankles, one black five-buckle overshoe over the other. He pulled his brown pipe from his back pocket and his tobacco from his raincoat. He'd been here for, well, a long time. And at least since they brought the statue in, hauled it on a ship from Michigan, maybe. Carroll recalled when the statue on the ship bobbed way out there on the horizon for the longest time. It looked like Piker McNugget the First standing on the water. A giant man with one hand raised, waving. People liked that, and so they kept it out there for a while. The statue now faced the water, the one hand waving, the other clenched in a fist at his side. He wore his traditional boots to the knee. There was a controversy about whether the statue should face the city or the water. Should Mr. McNugget wave to the town or the ships? Is he welcoming the ships or saying goodbye? Finally, he faced the water because the moving company with all its machinery from Michigan had to get back, and they just made the executive decision and faced him looking at the canal. But half the time, the statue was missing anyway. Some enterprising college kids, or who knows who, with some big machinery, often hauled it off somewhere for a prank. Up the hill, maybe halfway into the woods. And now, since former Mayor Piker McNugget, they say, isn't feeling so well, he's pretty much bedridden on London Road, but then he's supposed to be testifying at the thing the new mayor, Mary Pine, had got going, the big Truth and Reconciliation Commission with the county commissioners and all. But now, what was going to happen with that now? Well, nobody knew. And so these are tales Carroll can tell the folks from Bemidji and Pocatello and Berlin who come to visit, because he was right there when it happened. You can't get that kind of expertise anyway, but, well, just experience. Most of any job is just showing up. That's what his tata always said. Carroll waved when the ship shouted its horn. Maybe they saw him. He always waved, just in case. Then they turned at an even greater wailing and moaning behind him. He pushed his cart over there. Maybe he could sell something. Maybe this could be his start to the Christmas selling season as well. He eased the cart over the curb and looked both ways before going down the middle of the boulevard street. He took a little run to get up the driveway into the parking lot. Carroll pushed up to the edge of the activity. Ecstasy flashed in the faces of the children and the parents. Their cheeks glowed red, and their eyes and mouths stretched as wide open as they could possibly be, as they dashed everywhere with their wide open hands and mittens held to the sky. "What's going on?" Carroll asked the mother behind a stroller, directing her other children where to go by pointing with both hands. "Gold," she said. "It's gold, real gold." "Gold?" said Carroll, rubbing a little of the dust around in his fingers. "I thought it was taconite."
That's the news from Duluth, Minnesota, where all the police and soldiers are thugs. All the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We're allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There's no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LF police. No evidence from ground zero taken away before we can even look at it. We are not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing the United States politicians, journalists, and generals who have brought about this long 12-year war and debacle to trial, and put them on TV just like OJ every afternoon so every American can watch, just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. Right now we live on lies. We subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, they all know that. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country. We need to put certain people on the stand, and we need to be allowed to ask questions. Our country is surely broken as well. The troops are not protecting us. That's someone's spin on the day's news, somebody's advertising slogan, someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They're not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters, the ones who go face to face with the empire. Those in the plowshares movement, for one example. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attacks. He's complicit. He's lied. He's continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan based on a lie, and he knows he's lying. He lied right to our faces on national television when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Osama bin Laden was buried at sea, and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. See? There is a hole, a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. It went all the way into that hole. And well, no, there's no blood and no bodies and no luggage scattered or plane parts. And Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own government. like a horror movie. And the killer is in the same house with us. These killers are right here with us, and they want us to be afraid. We cannot be afraid. We've just about completed another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show, and we'd like to thank you for being here with us tonight. We apologize for the technical difficulties we had with some of our pre-recorded segments, and we hope you'll bear with us and come back again next week and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And I'd like to thank especially my co-host, Mike Palachek. Thank you and good night, Mike.
Good night, Chuck. Thanks to our guests, Phil Ferruccio, Ole Yamagard, Sherwood Ross, and Mickey Z. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to the show.newamericandream.info. Good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Salah. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.